Serious Fun, your step-by-step guide to leading remarkably fun programs that make a difference. Read by the author, Mark Collard. To access 40 free program templates, visit www.seriousfunbook.com. Dedication to Jilly, who blesses my life with her infinite love, and Devon, whose smile reflects the essence of serious fun every day. If you haven't got a lot of time. Key messages. This book describes a simple 4-step sequence I use to create remarkably fun programs. If you want to lead programs that are fun and make a difference to the lives and performance of your group, then I'm talking to you. Specifically, teachers, corporate trainers, youth leaders, camp leaders, outdoor educators, etc. Many program leaders adopt an outdated, boring approach to program design and delivery, which leads to unmotivated participants, unproductive teams, and unrewarding outcomes. It doesn't have to be this way. Group leaders commonly make one or more of 7 mistakes when leading their programs. 1. Not breaking the ice. 2. Lack of philosophical framework. 3. Unrealistic expectations. 4. Poor needs analysis. 5. Not valuing people's time. 6. Neglecting the power of story. 7. Absence of fun. Environment dictates performance. The key to leading programs which are outrageously fun and make a difference to the groups you work with is the type of environment you create. I have developed a powerful sequence that you can use to intentionally create this environment every time. This approach is not about being different. It is focused on creating a difference. Having fun is the key. Honoring choice, valuing people, and providing opportunities for growth and interaction with others are also critically important. Key methodology. This is the 4-step sequence I call the difference model. Step 1. Needs analysis or plan. This step asks, what difference is your program going to make to your group? This task is more than just setting goals. It's about clearly identifying how you want your group to be feeling at the end of your program. It applies to any space in which groups gather. Step 2. Setting the tone, or prime. Your leadership role? Coach. This step intentionally creates a fun, safe, and supportive environment where choice is honored and trust is built. All interaction occurs within your group's comfort zone, that is, the space within which people feel inspired and comfortable to interact with one another. This applies to conference openings, start of year orientations, new project teams. Step 3. Doing the work, or pump. Your leadership role, facilitator. Operating within a clearly defined framework which values people and provides opportunities for growth, this step invites your group to develop its communication, problem-solving, and responsibility skills. Much of this interaction occurs within your group's stretch zone, that is, that space which invites your group to build on its strengths and abilities to function more effectively. This step applies to team-building programs, youth meetings, adventure programs, and school classrooms. Step 4. The difference, or peak. Your leadership role, partner. Following this sequence, using the tools available to you, and doing everything you can to prepare your group will give them the best chance of not only getting what they came for, but so much more. The most rewarding outcome of this unique approach is experienced in the way your program leaves people feeling engaged, empowered, valued, and meaningfully connected to others. This applies to any group that wants to have fun while making a difference. Preface. A man was walking across the desert, stumbling, almost dying of thirst, when he saw a well. As he approached the well, he found a note in a can close by. The note read, "Dear friend, there is enough water in this well, enough for all, but sometimes the leather washer gets dried up and you have to prime the pump. Now, if you look underneath the rock just west of the well, you will find a bottle full of water, corked. Please don't drink the water. What you've got to do is take the bottle of water and pour the first half very slowly into the well to loosen up the leather washer. Then pour the rest in very quickly and pump like crazy. You will get water. The well has never run dry. Have faith, and when you're done, don't forget to put the note back, fill up the bottle, and put it back under the rock. Good luck. Have a fun trip. Sincerely, your friend, Desert Pete." From author Tim Hansel, from his book Holy Sweat. What would you do? You're desperate for water, about to expire from dehydration, and yet, in reality, the bottle of water is only enough to quench your thirst, not save your life. Would you risk it all? This story is a powerful allegory about some of the essential elements of this book. As I see it, you have three choices. First, you could read the note, choose to drink all of the water, and move on in your journey. Second, you could drink a little of the water and attempt to use the remainder to prime the pump. Or third, you could follow the instructions. The first choice is akin to reading this book, nodding your head, and continuing on your way. And this is fine. It is, of course, a choice. However, choosing not to add value to your program, your skills, a significant relationship, etc., is the same as taking it away. Your thirst for knowledge may be quenched, but you may have missed an opportunity to benefit many of the groups you work with today and tomorrow, not to mention the leaders of these groups who follow you. This first choice reminds me of the long-term consequences of the cat which jumps onto a hot stovetop. The cat will never jump onto a hot stove again, and that is good, but it will never jump onto the stove when it is cold either. Such is the experience of many people who have endured a boring, embarrassing, or downright threatening group experience in the past. They will balk at the prospect of repeating this experience a second or third or tenth time, no matter how safe it may in fact be. The second choice is a bit like hedging your bets, akin to placing a foot on both sides of a barbed wire fence. A move in any direction is likely to cause harm. Having drunk some of the water, you are likely to thirst again very soon, but worse, you will give up pumping because no matter how hard you work, you won't have enough of the vital ingredients to allow the pump to function properly. On paper, your program may promise to strike water, but in practice, it may fail to live up to its full potential because no matter how well-intentioned you may be, its capacity to make a difference will be stunted by a poor design. The third choice, my invitation to you, dear listener, will take courage. It's a risk. There is plenty of evidence in this book that will point you to a powerful way to draw water from your programming well. Yet, can you trust me? You may hear me asking you to pour the only water you are sure of, your experience, your qualifications, your intuition, etc., down the well. That is certainly not true. You do not need to turn your back on all that you know. But understand this, in learning, there is risk. I expect also to challenge some of your long-held, preconceived notions about how to break the ice, encourage people to participate, build trust, strengthen relationships, etc. I'm not saying that you don't know what you're doing, but I will invite you to stretch beyond what you already know. And consider that, with the right sort of preparation, there is always more value, or water, to pump out of your program. Finally, there is the instruction to work. This book is not a lazy person's guide to program design. Do not mistake the simple four-step methodology I shall describe to you as a substitute for work. I, along with Desert Pete, remind you that after you trust and risk, you must pump like crazy if you want to make a difference. My only promise is that once you know how to drill for water, you will never want to sip from a small bottle again. Part 1. Plan. The note. You never climb a mountain on accident. It has to be intentional. By Mark Udall, U.S. Congressman. I have applied the same approach to the writing of this book as the methodology I share within it. Accordingly, Part 1 is my plan, in which I create a map of the territory and survey the path to freedom. You will learn who I'm talking to, why I'm talking to you, and how I plan to talk to you. In Part 2, I equip you with all of the necessary thinking to prepare you for your journey. Without risk, you will learn the mistakes you should avoid, the best way to travel, and the benefits of trying something new. In Part 3, we do the work that matters. Step by step, you will learn everything you need to know, along with the tools you need to carry, to create remarkably fun programs which make a difference to your group. It is simple, but not always easy. Finally, in Part 4, we take what you have learned and apply it in practice, again and again, in many different situations. Chapter 1. Are you talking to me? If you run programs, events, or any sort of gathering which involves groups of people, students, staff, strangers, volunteers, young and old, then the answer is an emphatic yes. If you design and deliver programs for the purpose of recreation, education, professional or personal development, then yes, I'm talking to you too. 2-minute programs, year-long programs, 5 people, 5,000 people, yes. But most critical of all, if you want to lead programs and do work that matters, that which is fun and makes a difference to your group, then I'm talking to you. The approach, strategies, and leadership tips I share in this book apply to pretty much every group-based program, event, or gathering you could care to name. So, if you're a classroom teacher, corporate trainer, outdoor educator, adventure or experiential educator, conference and event organizer, scout or girl guide leader, camp leader, youth leader, group therapist, sports team coach, or one of many other positions of leadership, I am talking to you. Just so you know, this book has been written by an Australian. My nationality is irrelevant, except to say that from birth I have learned to speak in metric, and I am compelled to add the letter U to many words such as colour, labour, and favourite, or substitute the letter Z for S on occasions. No matter where you are from, I am glad that you are here. Feel free to convert and overlook the different letters at will. Chapter 2. What difference do you want to make? Act as if what you do makes a difference. It does. By William James, philosopher. A classroom of students look up at their teacher with empty eyes, bored out of their brains, thinking, same old, same old. An auditorium is filled with seasoned conference delegates, keeping to themselves, concerned that someone may sit next to them. With eyes focused anywhere other than the front of the room, you ask for someone to stand up and introduce themselves to kick off your training session. Do these situations sound familiar to you? Maybe you see yourself in them. Do you wish there was an alternative? There is, and this book reveals the answer. Every one of these situations is a sad reflection of a poor and outdated approach to programming. Imagine, instead, a class filled with students, all leaning in and eagerly participating in your discussion, or a conference room filled with warmth and laughter long before the keynote speaker has entered the room. Or consider for a moment your dilemma if every hand shot up when you needed a willing volunteer. If you are responsible for the design and delivery of some form of group-based program, a school classroom, staff training course, conference, youth group evening, residential camp, etc., then I expect you want the most powerful and rewarding outcome possible for your group. This book will show you how, in four clearly defined steps, answering many of your questions along the way. I have delivered countless programs for hundreds of groups and organizations all over the world, and I know that the most satisfying and successful programs for the participants and the leader are those which intentionally promote interaction, build trust, and take fun seriously right from the start. Notice I said intentionally and right from the start. You see, good outcomes don't just happen. They are created in the same way water is drawn from Desert Pete's well. There are certain elements which have to be present: instructions, strategy, risk, effort, to produce the desired results. Without these elements, all you have is potential, and potential on its own is not enough to satisfy your thirst. To this end, simply throwing a bunch of people together, even with a purpose, does not make a group work. When this occurs, and it does a lot, this is what I've noticed. If there's no trust, people pull back from participating fully. If there's no fun, people find it difficult to engage with the content or with others. And if there's no challenge, there's only boredom and no opportunity for growth. The result? Unhappy people, unsatisfactory results, and unfulfilled expectations. Un. For more than 25 years, program leaders have come to me because they experience three common problems. In essence, they want to remove the un. They find it difficult to engage unmotivated or unwilling participants. They lead groups which don't often get along or are unproductive. And they are given too little time to produce unrealistic outcomes. If one or more of these issues strikes a chord with you, then you're in the right place. This book will share a unique methodology which acknowledges the fact that, by our very nature, people don't like to step outside of their comfort zones. As complex beings, humans have continued to exist as a species because of a primal instinct to survive. Consequently, if a program is not fun, or people feel threatened, or there's any chance that they will look foolish, the program will fail to achieve its full potential. And yet, some program leaders wonder why they meet resistance. In the chapters which follow, I describe a simple yet powerful four-step model, which I call the difference model. It will equip you with the skills and strategies you need to prepare your group for success right from the start, ultimately helping you to deliver an extremely powerful program which you and your group will thoroughly enjoy. This unique approach appeals to people of all ages and works with nearly every type of program and curricula you can think of. At a glance, this is what you can look forward to. Step 1. Needs analysis or plan. Just as the man in our desert story would have died of thirst if he did not uncover the note, that is, no plan at all, he most certainly would have been unable to do more than quench his thirst if he had neglected to follow the instructions, the plan, and drank the water in the small bottle. This, the first deliberate step, is as critical as that desert note. You need a plan to guide your actions. In much the same way an annual budget means little more than an expression of an organization's priorities, this step is the starting point for the preparation and work which must follow. Things change, but without a clearly defined target, you may as well pack up and go home. You will learn how to set a target. This section will also help you to explore the questions you need to ask to fully understand your group and the task ahead of you, and, importantly, the difference you intend to make in your program or event. You can expect all of the regular questions to form an important part of your needs analysis, and a couple too, I suspect, which would challenge your thinking. Then, with note in hand, you are ready to get busy. Step 2. Setting the tone, or prime. Get this step right. It's not hard, but it is critical, and everything which follows will be so much easier and significantly more successful. It's the step most program leaders underestimate. This step sets the tone and begins the sensitive process of preparing your group and switching on their brains. Ask for too much by not adding the right amount of water to loosen the washer, and you'll frighten your group away. But progress too slowly, neglect to pump when you should, and there's a potential for boredom. There are several key elements involved in this step which will help you break the ice and, critically, create a platform upon which your group and program will thrive. But note, this step is not about playing icebreaker games. It's about breaking the ice, and yes, there is a difference. If you or your group cringe at the thought of icebreakers, then study this step carefully, because I'll reveal 5 reasons why most icebreakers don't work. For programs which gather people for only a short period of time, conferences for example, these first 2 steps may be all you need to apply. Whereas for longer term programs, once your group is switched on, they'll be ready to follow your lead onto the next challenge or whatever your program demands. Step 3. Doing the work, or pump. If you jump to this stage too early, which many program leaders do, you can expect trouble. Trouble looks like unwillingness to participate, put-downs, excuses, asking for too much and too little time, a lack of responsibility, just to name a few of the usual suspects. All of these issues can be avoided, or at a minimum, mitigated, by adhering to the key elements of the prime stage, which will prepare your group to willingly step outside of their comfort zone into what is commonly referred to as their stretch zone. This step will develop your group's hidden potential to flex and build their muscles, so to speak, for bigger and better things. It's not rocket science, but this step subscribes to the common understanding that the more you train and flex your muscles, the stronger you can expect to become. As this process can take time and you may need to pump like crazy on occasions, you may ask, why bother? 2 simple reasons. 1, if you really want to set your group up for the most powerful and rewarding experience possible, that's why you're here, isn't it? Why would you give your group only half a glass of water when they are sitting on a well? And 2, this step intentionally builds trust and strengthens relationships, the bedrock of group success, no matter the difference you're trying to make in your program. Do the work, pump like crazy, and you can expect more fun, more participation, more value, in this order. Step 4, the difference, or peak. Appropriately primed and pumped up, this final stage is the holy grail of programming, the ticking of boxes, the getting of stuff done, the reaching for stars. Now is the best time to deliver your content, develop those skills, and extract the highest quality water from your group's well. It's the reason your group is gathered and is the reason your program exists. Learning to swim, networking with strangers, constructing a complex sentence, solving interesting problems, delivering a keynote presentation, developing team skills, and so on. From a classroom filled with students to a corporate training room, or a conference auditorium filled with unfamiliar faces to a weekly youth group meeting, the more effort and time you invest in the development of your group, pumping like crazy, especially early on, the more powerful and rewarding your program or event or gathering will be. So, what difference do you want to make? The most frequently asked question. I deliver training workshops all over the world, and by far the most common question I get is this: how do you do what you do? Or in other words, what steps do I take to achieve the results I get? This book is my response. It is the first definitive step-by-step guide designed specifically to help novice and experienced program leaders create remarkably fun programs, which produce the most powerful and rewarding outcomes possible. Why? To help you make a difference in the world. The strategies and leadership tips I share can be applied to almost any group-based program, from a two-minute conference energizer to a dynamic semester-long curriculum. It's light on theory, easy to use, and can be applied quickly by ordinary people with little or no cost. Then, underpinned by my four-step programming model, I explore dozens of practical solutions to answer many more frequently asked questions, such as, where do I start? How do I get everyone to participate? How do I break the ice? What can I do to help my team function better? How do I manage difficult behaviors, such as a dominant personality? What are the best ways to divide large groups into smaller groups? How can I draw more value from my group's experience? How can I manage large groups on my own? How can I achieve unrealistic outcomes with too little time? What do I do to make my job easier? I share the best of my knowledge drawn from 25 plus years of trial and error programming with tens of thousands of people from all over the world. I believe this wisdom and that borrowed from my peers will scaffold your program for unbelievable success and leave your group feeling incredibly engaged, valued, and inspired, exceeding all of their and your expectations. If you want to have fun, do work that matters, and make a difference, then I invite you to embrace the approach I share in this book. I hope you do. Your group will thank you for it. Part 2. Prime. The bottle of water. Always do your best. What you plant now, you will harvest later. By Og Mandino, author. There are a few things that I'd like to share with you before we charge headlong into the four steps of my programming model. By all means, skip ahead and start absorbing the details of my methodology. You'll find what you need to get started. However, gaining first an understanding of the philosophical framework of my approach, not to mention the research which underpins it, will help you to make sense of my programming model and the practical solutions at the back of the book. I expect also that the next few sections will answer some key questions you may have at this point, such as, who am I and why should you listen to me? What sort of problems will this book solve? Is the approach I share scientifically researched and proven? What's in it for you? In other words, this part will prime you, that is, set the tone for the rest of the book. Chapter 3. In your shoes. I've been in your shoes. Well, not your actual shoes, but you know what I mean. My name is Mark, and I'm a professional training consultant. I'm the author of two top-selling publications in the training and education field, and with more than 25 years of experience working with thousands of people all over the world, I know what it's like to work with groups that worry they're going to be asked to do something embarrassing, don't want to move from their seats, are not interested or are unwilling to participate, don't get along or don't work well together, are made up of people who have been forced to attend, exhibit antisocial and/or difficult behaviours, waste a lot of time waiting for people to arrive, are so large that it's very easy for some people to hide, ask for too much in too little time, and I'm sure you could add many, many more types to this list. These groups have been the bread and butter of my career. Of course, I've worked with many more wonderfully cooperative, playful, and talented groups too, but the truth is, I cut my programming teeth on the rough edges of these less than ideal but wholly worthy groups. Oh, the fun I've had inviting each and every one of these groups to play, share, and interact. Yet, as I have juggled all of these issues, I have often wondered if others felt the same way I do. On occasion, I'd come home at the end of a difficult program and start to doubt my ability to cut through the crap and make a difference. I'd sometimes look out at the sea of faces before me and wonder if they're going to like me. Deep down, I really just want to know that I'm good enough and worthy of their love. I've slumped in my bed at the end of a day, exhausted from putting out fires and generating all of the energy in my program, and wake in the morning to find the bedroom light still on. I've waded through dozens of activity books, which promise tons of fun and interaction, but not one of them tells me how to apply these experiences to my group. Then, on the flip side, as a participant, I've looked at others in my group to see the same look of discomfort in their eyes as yet another inappropriate group activity is introduced. Tell me, did you see yourself in any of these situations? All of them, and many, many more, have caused me to wonder if there was a better way. There is. In my shoes, I'm on a mission to transform the design and delivery of group-based programs from so-so to awesome. I want to transform your experience of the time you spend in front of groups from that of, oh no, here we go again, to, wow, that was amazing. I've been in your shoes. There is a better way. It's time we changed our thinking and our approach. That's what this book is all about. Chapter 4. Seven Mistakes Program Leaders Make. People will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. By Maya Angelou, author. To be fair, most of the problems I described on the page you just turned are not actually problems. They are symptoms. They are what shows up or manifests when one or more problems lurk in the background. For example, people not willing to participate in your program could, perhaps, be a symptom of an unsafe or unfriendly atmosphere. Late arrivals could be a symptom of, perhaps, not giving your group a reason to arrive on time, and so on. I fervently believe that approach is everything. That is, everything that you do and don't do during the life of your program, before, during, and after, will impact your group and therefore your program outcomes. Your program does not start once you have everyone's attention or resume when your group returns from the lunch break. Who you are being and the approach you adopt, which significantly influences the way people are feeling and interacting, will determine your program's success. If you drill down deep enough into the most common issues, you will uncover a handful of mistakes, and they all come under the heading of approach. Yes, yes, I know there are groups out there which even their own mothers find difficult to love. I've worked with them too. Suggesting that no matter how good your program is, these folks will always give you trouble. Yeah, I get that. But the truth is, you can't change how people think or what they do without first changing how they feel. To this end, you are well advised to focus all of your efforts on your approach because it is one of the most powerful tools to influence how people feel at your disposal. That said, here are the top seven mistakes I believe program leaders make that get them into all sorts of trouble. Mistake number one, not breaking the ice or asking too much too soon. By far the most serious, far-reaching mistake program leaders make is not adequately breaking the ice. That is, failing to remove the obstacles which prevent people from fully and safely interacting with others and the program. Fundamentally, this is the source of almost all of the issues described so far, and possibly those which persist in your group right now. Indeed, I'll even be so bold as to say, if you're meeting resistance anywhere in your program, then I'll wager a tenner that you have not adequately thawed the ice that your group is experiencing. I fervently believe that if people are not having fun or do not feel valued or there's any chance that they could look foolish in front of others, they will find it very difficult to willingly and fully engage in your program, no matter the purpose of the group experience, whether they're at school, at work, in training, or at play. Basically, any task that requires an individual or a group of people to step outside of their comfort zones, more on this later, before they are ready to do so, will trigger a set of feelings, behaviours, and survival instincts which may ultimately stunt the success of your program. Or, to put it simply, asking too much too soon puts people off. Ice forms when strangers, meeting for the first time, are asked to share their most embarrassing moments. Or it will develop immediately the prospect of having to speak in front of others presents itself. Ice will also form when something or someone challenges a group's long-held beliefs. Arriving late, making excuses, deliberately sitting two seats away from one another, lying, acting out, and looking down at the ground are all great examples of ice manifesting itself. The more ice you have, the more difficult it will be to achieve your program goals. A more powerful approach is to always expect it to be present, even among people who know each other very well. There is always ice, even if only to your program, so prepare accordingly. Later, I will share a simple checklist which you can apply easily to your program to help you break the ice effectively. Do this well, and you will not only attract significantly more participation, but the quality of the interaction will open up many new opportunities for your group. Mistake number two, lack of philosophical framework, or environment dictates performance. In my experience, most programs lack a powerful philosophical grounding because this is what I see and hear people say all the time. They said we had a choice, but we rarely got to exercise it. I often feel under pressure not to say anything. There's not many of us, but I feel invisible. We had a lot of fun, but I have no idea what this has to do with. If these comments sound familiar to you, this may be a sign that your programmatic philosophy is out of whack. It's more than just the impact of mixed messages. It's the difference between an approach that supports your program goals or one that runs counter to it. Your philosophical framework is the lens through which you view the world, your program, and the people in it. For example, if you view people as, or expect them to be, obedient, you will rarely give them a choice. If you believe that learning is self-evident, then you won't bother to extract meaning from an experience. If you think people tend to feel and act like you do, then you'll expect them to speak up for themselves or take the initiative or willingly try something new for the first time, and so on. I don't know about your experience, but these beliefs do not match the psychology of the thousands of people I have worked with over the years. Generally speaking, when people feel threatened or disempowered or have no idea what they are doing, all of which stem from an unhealthy environment, they tend to pull back from participating fully or worse, actively sabotage you, the group, or the program. The truth is that environment dictates performance. The more powerful the environment, the more powerful you can expect your results to be. No matter if your group has just met for the first time, or they have been together for many years, anything you can do which will positively influence the environment within which your group may interact will help you to produce more satisfying results every time. In part three, I will share five useful tools that you can use to help you avoid this mistake and develop the hallmarks of a powerful philosophical framework. Mistake number three, unrealistic expectations, or assuming you already know. The first two mistakes are the most common and arguably the most debilitating features of a poor programming approach. Having unrealistic expectations pops up as another big problem. We all know the importance of setting goals. As the saying goes, how can you possibly know if you've arrived if you don't know where you're going? This is true, but as important as this process is, I'm not referring just to the process of setting clearly defined goals. The mistake I refer to, of forming unrealistic expectations, focuses on three key issues. First, While solving a group's needs or problems is very important, the more important task is problem finding. While it is clearly very important to solve the problem, as distinguished from the symptom, it is critical that you focus on the right problem. For example, I know of some groups which have been sent away on expensive team-building exercises when the real problem remained behind, sitting in the manager's office. In these cases, the expressed need for team building was really a misnomer for the manager just wanting his or her staff to do what they're told to do. Second, sometimes what the client or group is expecting is altogether different from what the program leader is prepared to deliver. Mostly, this is caused by poor communication, but it is just as damaging to the program as much as it is to the group's success. A striking example comes to mind. A father and son group I led many years ago arrived one weekend fully expecting to climb the high ropes course at the end of the day. Fair enough, too, because this was the clearly defined and communicated goal of our program. However, within minutes of getting off the bus, it was apparent that this group did not share a high regard for safety or procedures. Later in the day, as the behaviour of the group deteriorated, I had to decide if I would permit the group to harness up and climb the high elements. On the basis that this group had not demonstrated any level of safety consciousness, I chose no. Now, I upset a client that day, and I have to admit I was partly to blame. The mistake I made was to create an expectation in my client's mind that the group would climb the high elements, because this is what I said would happen. Yet upon witnessing their interactions up close, it was very clear that this was an unrealistic expectation. Since that day, I have chosen the words I use with clients more carefully, instead promising to use a variety of adventure-based activities in my programs, some of which may include the elements of a high-challenge ropes course. And thirdly, many a program has gone awry on the basis of an unrealistic or assumed expectation that the group comes equipped with a supportive, productive, and healthy culture. No, not often. Certainly not newly formed groups, and rarely even among long-established, intact groups. It is safer to assume that groups, generally, do not know how to behave in the most positive, supportive, and productive manner. To this end, you are well advised to set some clearly defined expectations around what it means to be involved in your program. More on this in Part 3. Mistake number 4. Poor needs analysis, or not knowing whom you're working with. This mistake should be self-explanatory. More often than not, if a program fails to achieve its objectives, a poor understanding of the client's needs is at the heart of the problem. A classic example. In the midst of a busy month of programs, I chose to spend the time on my flight between Melbourne and Sydney to plan a last-minute program. The client called me only 3 days in advance, and we discussed all of the normal program parameters, such as venue, numbers, goals, duration, etc. I picked up my rental car at the airport, tackled peak hour traffic, and finally arrived at the venue with 2 minutes to spare. Then, as I swaggered into the reception area to inquire where I should be, I looked around and figured I must be in the wrong place because it had all the signs of an aged care facility. Panicked, thinking I was now late, I turned to walk back to my car when I heard my name. I was, in fact, at the right place. One very important question I forgot to ask was the age of the participants, an average of 75 years. I thought, there goes my 3 hours of high-energy games out the window. In the world of realistic expectations, another shortfall of a poor needs analysis is the decision to commit to a shorter program than is realistically required, or to a program that lies outside of one skill set. If you want to do the very things that groups value about your work, then you must say no to opportunities that require more time or budget than your client is willing to give, or more skills than you can realistically offer. If you believe that you must keep your promises and meet your group's needs, this may mean suggesting follow-up sessions or multi-day programs or a decision to involve other professionals. Anything less is akin to handing your group a half-filled glass of water when they thirst for a full glass. In part three, we'll look at what a thorough needs analysis looks like and how it can help you to exceed your group's expectations. Mistake number five, not valuing people's time or wasting opportunities. One of the biggest thieves of value in a program, any program, is permitting waste. The worst offender of them all is not starting on time, and this waste is all the more painful because it is totally avoidable. An illustration. Let's say your program starts at 9 a.m. and finishes at 4 p.m. Allowing for multiple breaks and lunch, you may be left with, say, 5.5 hours of actual program time. Multiply that by the number of people in your group, multiplied by their respective pay scales, or the opportunity cost of doing something else in the case of non-commercial programs, and you can expect the cost per minute to be extremely high. And yet, we permit people to show up late. Indeed, we build this waste into the program. Really? I don't get it. Not only does delaying the official start reward those who are late, but it punishes those who arrive on time. So, what's the message here? It's okay to show up late? An extremely costly mistake. You only have to look at any university lecture hall to understand this mentality. The average student thinks, why turn up on time when the teacher will only wait for latecomers anyway? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy because the teacher chooses to delay the start of his or her lecture to allow more time for students to arrive. This rant is not about punctuality or picking on people who, for all intents and purposes, are just being rude. No, I want to focus your attention elsewhere. More powerfully, I prefer to shift the responsibility for this waste onto me, the program leader. I believe this all-too-common mistake presents an opportunity to add extra value, an opportunity we shall explore with many practical examples in Part 4. Mistake number 6. Neglecting the power of story, or our brains think in pictures. How often have you related your fascination with the latest TV commercial to others, only to realize you can't recall the actual product being advertised? Such is the power of story. As I look around, a very common mistake many program leaders make is to neglect the powerful medium of telling stories in their programs. They rely too heavily on their ability to articulate or their charismatic personality, or worse, the presumption that their group will remember everything they say. Rarely do these skills alone stick the key messages of a program in the minds of people as powerfully and for as long as stories. Stories are just one of the tools you can use to make a difference for your group, to help you do work that matters. In short, the absence of stories will stunt the power and enjoyment of your program. Stories don't have to be humorous, but they should reflect a purpose aligned to your program. A well-placed story can open a gathering with a laugh, or illustrate a key point in your presentation, or set the scene for the delivery of what's coming next. For example, consider my choice to use the imagery of a water pump in the desert at the start of this book. This suggestion alone will conjure in your mind most of the basic elements of the story I pitched, and with some further thought, how it connects to the purpose of this book. I often coach participants in my training workshops to draw pictures of their experience rather than write a lengthy step-by-step description of what happened, because the brain thinks in pictures, not in words. This is why the process of mind mapping is so powerful, and why stories, which are effectively a series of images, work so well. Our memories of anything are made up of pictures, not words. Here's an example. Elephant. Instantly, I can guarantee your mind will have retrieved the image of an elephant in your mind's eye, and not the actual word. Or consider the sketch of an elephant in your diary, for instance. The image will trigger a whole sequence of memories connected to your first elephant ride in India 10 years ago, something you may not have thought of in years. Stories are fun, they are powerful, and in my experience, are not used as often as they should be, especially when people interact and respond to them so well. This is a mistake, and one that can be quickly overcome. Mistake number 7. Absence of fun or flow, or what's in it for me? As mentioned earlier, if people cannot see the fun in an experience, they will find it very difficult to engage in your program. You could have everything else in order. You may have thoroughly analyzed your group's needs, developed realistic expectations, started on time, etc. And yet, if you neglect to make the overall experience fun, your program will fail. Now, when I say fun, I don't necessarily mean rolling around on the floor in fits of laughter. Don't get me wrong, this can be fun. But the fun I am particularly referring to is a level of engagement and general sense of enjoyment which nourishes one's soul or well-being. Yes, it may make you smile, but many more things beyond humour make you and I smile. Time after time, I have sat through a boring presentation, or a threatening conference session, or an awkward group interaction, and in all cases, I would argue no one was having any fun. These types of experiences will spoil any chance you have of creating a memorable and powerful group experience, that is, to make a difference. When you boil it down, having fun can be as simple as sharing an experience, any experience, in which you get lost in the flow. Flow is a state of mind, much like the way Dr. Stuart Brown, founder of the National Institute for Play, describes the properties of play. It is attractive, voluntary, purposeless, free of time and self-consciousness, and you want it to last forever. Going to the movies, engaging in a long, in-depth conversation, playing sport, even when you lose, scaling a rock climbing wall, starting a new enterprise. All of these experiences can be fun because they involve many of the critical properties of flow. While there is no special formula, I will say that fun and flow will only occur when one critical element is present, a conducive environment. There must be choice, people must feel valued, opportunities for challenge and growth are possible, and most important of all, there must be some form of interaction with oneself, others, and/or the environment. Let's be honest. How many of these elements are truly present in your program? If there is one thing I want you to take away from this book, it's this. The key to leading programs which are remarkably fun and meaningful is the type of environment you create. Our next chapter will explore a simple yet very powerful model which reveals the secret to creating the most conducive type of programming environment every time.